Welcome to the High Existence Podcast, where we ponder, explore, and expand this wondrous experience called life. Visit highexistence.com for a daily boost to your consciousness.
Hello, Hedens. Welcome to the High Existence Podcast. My name is Martijn Schurp, and in today's episode, I am joined by my awesome co-host, Jordan Lejuan. On this show, Jordan and I talk to all kinds of truly amazing individuals, from futurists to meditation experts, and from writers to health geeks. In our explorations, we want to discover the different habits and hacks to fully realize our physical, spiritual, and cultural potential. If you want to send us feedback, just want to say hi, or have any other suggestion, like who you want to see in the show, just send us a personal message on highexistence.com. I am very excited about today's show, since we have two wonderful speakers as our guests, Tom Schroeder and Nicholas Blackstone. Tom is the author of Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal, one of the best books out there about the history and potential of using psychedelics as medicines. The book tells the intertwined stories of Rick, Michael, and Nicholas. Rick Dublin, our guest on a previous show, is the visionary behind the nonprofit organization MAPS that gives critical funding to psychedelic research. Michael Mithoover is a psychedelic therapist who currently treats individuals who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome with the psychedelic methylene dioxymethylamphetamine, also known as ecstasy, Molly, or MDMA. And lastly, Acid Test tells the very personal story of Nicholas Blackstone. He's a former Marine, and he tells how MDMA-assisted therapy enabled him to go deep inside and confront the demons that haunted him after heavy combat in Iraq. Acid Test is one of my favorite books because it unequivocally shows that psychedelics can be used as medicines. In particular, how MDMA can be used as a gentle technology to assist individuals in their own healing process with paradigm-crossing results. By showing the transformative potential of psychedelics through the lives of Rick, Michael, and Nicholas, Acid Test has convinced me about the importance of healing trauma in ourselves and our communities, and that thus, legalization of psychedelics, the medicines that can greatly assist us in this goal, is perhaps the most important civil rights issue today. Seriously, I can highly recommend grabbing your copy of the book right now, read it, and then share it with as many people as you can. As Rick made clear on a previous show, coming out of the psychedelic closet is of utmost importance today. Without further ado, please enjoy the show.
I'm here with Martijn Schurp from the High Existence Podcast. Today we're speaking with Tom Schroeder, and Tom is the former editor of the Washington Post magazine, where he oversaw two Pulitzer Prize-winning feature stories. His most recent book was published in September, the name of which is Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. This book is an awesome story about the resurgence of research into the medical use of psychedelic drugs and the people behind it. And his earlier book, Old Souls, is a classic study of the intersection between mysticism and science. And we also have on the show Nicholas Blackstone, who's a former Marine and a participant in the MAPS clinical trial of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. Nick joined the Marines out of high school and saw combat in the Iraqi cities of Fallujah and Ramadi and suffered severe post-traumatic stress disorder until participation in experimental trials using MDMA-assisted therapy allowed him to face the roots of his disorder and heal himself. His story is told in Tom's book, Acid Test. So welcome, guys. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Well, Tom, could you tell us a bit about the story of Acid Test, how it came to be and what it mainly is about?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's kind of a long backstory how it came to be. And it's, yeah, so one of those weird accumulation of coincidences. But, you know, when I was in college in the early 70s, I was interested. I got to be interested in psychedelics through some personal experience that I had, you know, where they seemed to produce experiences that had some lasting value. It wasn't just about, quote, getting high or anything. It actually seemed to help me improve myself as a person. And just, I'll just give you one example. I took some mushrooms, and as they began to take effect, I actually got anxious, and that anxiety began to ratchet up, and I began to sort of obsess about all these things that I was worried about, not only right in the immediate present, but things that were coming up like a week away, a month away, and then just into the deep future. And I began to sort of see all that worry and fear as this real weight, a physical weight I felt on my body. And then as the sort of mushroom effect began to accelerate, I suddenly had this vision of like this boulder on my chest. And, you know, I could almost not breathe. But then I saw that I was actually struggling to hold the boulder to my chest. And it was sort of like, here was this oppressive weight that I was actually choosing and making a great effort to keep holding. And all I had to do was open my arms and it would fall away. Wow. And so I did that. And from that moment on, you know, the rest of my life, I've been aware that to a certain extent, and maybe even to a large extent, all these negative emotions that we have are to some degree a choice. And in fact, sometimes you're expending great energy to have those negative emotions, and that you have it within your power to simply let them go, and they'll fall. And that has been of immense value to me. It doesn't mean that it's always easy to do.
Right.
But because I had that vision, and you know, because the nature of psychedelics are that it's not an intellectual thought. I mean, it's easy to have that intellectual thought that we're making a choice to feel bad. But when you actually saw it as a concrete reality, and you actually saw the weight as a boulder, and you saw your arms holding it, and you actually could feel yourself opening your arms and feel it fall away, that really made me know for a fact that this was true. And because I knew that, I was able to work on it as an individual. Okay, well, so that's the background. I was interested in psychedelics. And I went to the University of Florida, but I lived in Sarasota, Florida, and I was home on spring break. And I saw somewhere, maybe there was a little blurb in the local paper, or maybe I was just driving around, and it was about this hippie who was building this magnificent house, you know, with natural stone and timber and this huge stained glass window that he commissioned, this really fantastic house. And just like a comment about his philosophy about the house made it clear to me, even though he didn't say it in this many words, that this house was kind of him trying to take his insights gained from LSD trips and make them into concrete reality, to kind of put them into normal life. Because that's always the thing, right? I mean, if you think that you're having insights when you're having a psychedelic experience, the real question is, is that insight really worth something going forward in everyday life? And he was explicitly trying to use what he'd learned doing psychedelics to put into the design and the execution of building this house. So I found that really interesting. And I went, and I was a student journalist. I was the editor of my college newspaper. And I decided that it would be interesting to write a feature article about this guy. So I went out and I spent the day with him, and I wrote the article, and it ran in the paper. And, you know, I didn't really think much of it again until 10 years later. I was out of college. I was the editor of the Miami Herald Sunday magazine, Tropic. And I saw a little notice in the Tampa paper that there was this sort of perpetual college student there who was proclaiming this new drug called ecstasy as being the future of psychotherapy.
Wow.
And I'm looking at this, and they have a picture of the guy, and I'm thinking, oh my God, that's the same guy that I met in the woods that day. And it was. And so I assigned a reporter to go do a cover story on him. And I think I think the headline was a Timothy Leary for the 80s. And so that ran, and it was a really interesting story. And he was kind of a wild man in there, and sort of definitely more or less an outlaw at that time. And this was just at the moment where they were going to put MDMA or ecstasy on Schedule 1 along with LSD and the other psychedelics, as well as heroin. and make it illegal. So then another 15 years go by. And by this point, I'm the editor of the Washington Post magazine. And I'm looking at the New York Times, and there's a small story about how Harvard is doing the first research, clinical research with psychedelic drugs since they booted Tim Leary out the door. And as I'm reading the story halfway down, I see it's sponsored by an organization called the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And the director and founder of that is a guy named Rick Doblin, who happens to be the same guy as the hippie in the woods and the Timothy Leary for the 80s. That I just said, okay, this is too much. This time I'm going to do the story myself. So I called him up, and I was shocked to discover that he not only remembered me and his various connections with me through the years, he had both the story that I wrote in college and the story that ran in Tropic Magazine on his desk at that very moment that I was talking to him. Wow. Because he just made a presentation to his board of directors. And his point was that his image had come a long way from this, you know, this sort of outlaw hippie to someone who was sponsoring a study at one of the preeminent institutions of higher learning in the world. You know, and so I went up to do the story. But interestingly, of course, I think Rick had a little overestimated how far his image had come, because while I was reporting the story, the administration of Harvard's psychiatric hospital where the research was going to be done changed hands, and there was a new president. And that new president took one look at Rick and said, "We're not taking any of his money. We don't want anything to do with this guy." So there was still this huge stigma, and that would become the story that, even though the science had advanced to the point where it was quite clear that psychedelics were safe to use in clinical settings and that they were potentially valuable, it was still this huge uphill battle. And that struggle to leave the stigma behind and to really explore the dramatic potential that these drugs have for therapy, that's really the story that's told in Acid Test. But when they canceled the research at Harvard, there was an ongoing research program that Rick had sort of managed to get started with a psychiatrist named Michael Midhofer in Charleston, South Carolina. And he was using MDMA to treat PTSD and largely female victims of rape and sexual abuse. So I went down there, and, you know, I was just floored by how successful this therapy was. I interviewed a lot of the participants whose lives had basically been destroyed by their PTSD. And I listened to and saw the tapes of their therapy sessions. And I saw the moments where they had these sort of blinding flashes of insight that began their healing. And I was so impressed with it. And I knew I wanted to write a book about this, but I also knew that there would still be sort of skepticism among mainstream publishers. And at this point, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had both begun, and already we were becoming aware of this huge problem we were going to have of vets who were coming home either with both physical injuries, but also with post-traumatic stress disorder. That was going to be this crippling, horrible problem. And I knew that Michael Midhofer and Rick Doblin were planning to have a second trial using MDMA to treat PTSD related to combat. And so I thought, you know what? That's a great opportunity to sell a book idea, because everybody in this country knows the sacrifice that we're asking of these often young people who we're sending to fight our wars for us. So the fact that this therapy might help this really horrendous problem is something that even the mainstream is going to have difficulty ignoring. So that's the time to really present this. And that's what I did. I waited, but I needed to be sure that I had somebody who was willing to sort of come out in front of the public and tell their story thoroughly about getting PTSD and what it did to them and allowing me to observe their therapy. And I knew that that was going to take somebody with tremendous courage because, you know, first of all, PTSD makes you do horrible things. You feel like part of the problem with it is you hate yourself. You feel like a monster. And then imagine sort of revealing all those things that have been torturing you just for the exact reason that you feel like you're a monster. And then letting someone observe this most intimate possible moments of your therapy. So I was worried that nobody was, and justifiably, that nobody was going to be willing to do that. But then I got in contact with Nick, and he felt so strongly that this had helped him that he wanted to, that he really felt like he owed it to all his comrades from the war to put himself out on the line so that maybe they could get the same kind of healing that he had.
Nick, could you walk us through a bit of your background and your preconceptions and your first experience about the MDMA therapy and how it helped you?
Yes. Well, as you said before, I was in the Marine Corps. I joined right after high school, born and raised here in Paducah, Kentucky. Went in the Marine Corps as an infantry contract and became a machine gunner. And then when I was put into 1-6 Weapons Company, I ended up going off to my first deployment to Fallujah, which wasn't that bad compared to my second deployment to Ramadi. And Ramadi was a hellhole, a literal minefield of explosives buried under roads and an enemy you never know where they could come from. When they did pop out and attack you, they would just take off their black mask and blend right back into the public. So being in constant firefights every day, I was the lead machine gunner in my platoon. So I was right there in the shit, as you would say, all the time. So anyway, when I got back from my second deployment, it wasn't until about 6 months later or so that I was kind of started noticing some issues. One of the big issues, well, this was actually right when I got back that day. I had a little breakdown. I wanted to go to the beach, and I went with my mother and my fiance at the time, now my wife. And we went to the local beach there on Camp Lejeune, and they happened to be shooting some artillery out into the ocean. And every time the concussion went off, I would just be sucked right back into the vehicle that I was in when I got blown up in Iraq, in Ramadi. And I just kept experiencing it. And every time they'd fire a shell, every time that concussion went off, I would be back in the vehicle. And I'm trying to drive at this moment, and I just pull off the side of the road and break down, crying and screaming. And I was yelling at like the enemy for some reason. I don't know why, but my mom and my fiance at the time just put their hands on my shoulder. They really didn't know what to do. To make a long story short, I ended up getting some help with the deployment health center there. They put me on Zoloft and Seroquel for sleep and give you a little one hour talk therapy session, which really isn't enough. But needless to say, the medicine was inadequate and really made me feel more like a zombie than anything. And I mean, they really do have a problem on their hands with so many people coming back with PTSD. Once I got out of the Marine Corps, I felt in 2008, I kind of felt a little bit better, I guess, just to be out of the uniform. But when I started school, a lot more issues started coming up. I started suffering from nightmares, having these night terrors and waking up in puddles of sweat. I was very rageful. I would snap at it in an instant. Just my wife could simply say, "I'm starving." And I would blow up on her and say, "You have no idea what starving is." And I would just, I turn into this monster. And a lot of the times I'd be able to see myself almost like third person and really just watch myself and see how I was being. And I just couldn't stop myself. And nothing anyone would say or anything I could say could get through to me. While I was in Ramadi, my vehicle was attacked with an RPG, which is a rocket propelled grenade. They hit my vehicle. My vehicle is blown up. My driver died, and I took shrapnel to my butt and legs, and a little bit to my left testicle. And I would relive that experience of what happened multiple times a day. It just constantly going through my head and reliving it. I was done with the pills. When I started having issues with the, while I was going through school, I got to the VA and they gave me the same pills, the same 1 hour talk of therapy session. And it just, I wasn't on that as long as I was the medicine in the Marine Corps. So I got off of it and I was looking for alternative help. At the time, I did remember my first experience smoking marijuana. And I remember that that had actually helped. I'd actually was able to smoke while overseas and safely. And I remember it was after I'd gotten blown up. It was around February time of the following year. And I just remembered staring out in that city. Every day I would have to suit up and stand at those walls like a, I don't know, like a gladiator about to have to go into the Colosseum every day. And you don't know if you're going to walk back through those gates. But that time when I was at night and I'd smoked, I just looked out at the city and I was at peace, and I was able to fall asleep at peace. And I just remember that, that inner peace. And so I found smoking kind of helped with the symptoms, but you know, after it kind of wore off, I was still having some issues. I got online and I ended up seeing a video of a woman talking on CNN about her involvement in a research study where they were giving MDMA treat her PTSD, and just talking about how much it helped her. And at that time, I really was on the end of my rope. I was suffering from suicidal issues a lot because you feel hopeless. Like there's nothing that can get through to you. There's nothing that can help. All your other brothers and sisters are suffering as well. Some of them don't even want to talk about it, and they're committing suicide, and you have this hopeless feeling. Luckily, I found MAPS, the research study they were doing, and it happened to be conducted in Charleston, South Carolina. I was living in Somerville, which is just north of there. I called and called and called and kept leaving messages, and eventually I was very lucky to get in. And I wasn't, when it comes to medicines or drugs or whatever you want to call it, I really didn't trust things that were chemically concocted by man. I was already fed up with pills. So I really wasn't too sure about MDMA or anything that was made like that. I had tried mushrooms myself before. There were ones I had made myself. It was during that time where I was looking for that alternative help. So I was kind of familiar with the psychedelic experience. When I took MDMA for the first time, it was somewhat similar to that dissolving period that occurs. And I had already talked to the Michael and Annie Mithover, the therapist who administered the drug. I'd already talked to them a couple weeks before about, you know, my story, and they prepared me for what I was going to be experiencing. But whenever I first experienced MDMA, this wave of anxiety came over me. I just heard this voice inside that was reminding me to breathe. And Michael Mithover had told me that before about remembering my breath. But for some reason in that experience, I really felt it. It wasn't just like Tom had said earlier, it's not just something intellectual that's told to you. You actually feel it. And I don't think I've ever tried to describe it before, but I can attempt to. Whenever I breathe, it kind of pulled me back to the center or the now or moment, however you want to say it. And whenever you're in the future, you always seem to be concerned about things that haven't even happened yet. When you're in the past, you're worried about things that you can't even change or do anything about. And with PTSD, a lot of times you're continuously pulled back to the past by these issues and traumas that you went through. Whenever I was able to breathe, it pulled me to the center, and I really felt like I was at the center of some circle, equal distance from the circumference, and I could see everything equally with no judgment. Or if I was on the center, say it was like a plate and it's balanced on the center, if I tried to go out towards the edge, like focusing on something in the future or past, you would lose that balance and, you know, spin into this kind of chaotic moment. So I really understood the power of my breath. And even after the sessions were over, I realized how it wasn't just something under the influence of the drug. It was like this real power that I had innate, that everyone has innate, about how you can breathe and really kind of pull yourself to the center and kind of push away a lot of that fog that comes from being into the past or being in the future.
Right.
I had a total of 6 sessions of MDMA. The first 3 sessions were blind study. They didn't know what dosage I was getting. And if you were getting the low or medium dose, you could choose to stay in for another session, 3 sessions of the full dose. And that was my case. I was only getting 75 milligrams in the beginning. And then I chose to stay in for another 3 sessions. Whenever I had the 125 milligram dose, I had this experience when it was setting in that my whole body was completely on fire. And I was getting kind of taken apart, put back together, and then I'd lose my mind and I'd get it back together. And my flesh just felt like it was burning. But the whole time I'm just laying down with eye shades on and listening to music. Like, I wasn't shooting up and out of the bed and freaking out or anything. I was kind of inward and calm, but going through this experience, I'd realized that the burning sensation had to do with me being kind of on fire whenever we got blown up, being in all those flames and everything. And the MDMA really helps you pull these experiences forward, you know, to where you process them, but without fear. Like, in the past, I would talk about these things, and even trying to tell you about them, I'd start panicking, and because the mind seems to put the body back in that state where it thinks it's there. So I guess, to make a long story short, with all the different traumas that I experience, it just helped me integrate them and learn from them, process them as information, and really feel like it's in the past. To be able to talk about it is, I guess, just a testament to show that it really does help you kind of put it in the past. I mean, there's nothing that can ever erase the things that you see in combat. Those images will always be burned pretty much into my soul, but I'm no longer affected by them, to where I'm, you know, debilitated and I, you know, can't move or function. I can function now. And I feel like I've regained that part of myself that I cut off, that part of myself that I thought was a monster that had no use here in America, was only useful to, I guess, to kill. But I changed my perspective on that. I saw that differently. And I was able to integrate myself as a whole, see how those things that I did over there were, I mean, they were what they were. I didn't choose to kill. I was in a situation where I had the choice to kill or be killed. Wow. And when you only have those choices and you're trained to make the decision to always fight, never quit, I mean, you just can't help the hand you've been dealt. So a lot of it is this inward forgiveness, about forgiving yourself for those things and seeing the higher perspective of it, which is hard to explain. But the MDMA experience really helped me see that and feel that.
Wow. So, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, wow, man. It really makes sense. Such a story. Like, the PTSD sounds, and the things you went through with war, it sound like really bad altered states, really bad experiences. And I'm glad you got the MDMA and you got better. Do you feel like you are completely cured now? Or are there moments where you're thinking, like, I would wish another session?
Well, I will tell you, there are times I wish that I could go back for just one session of just processing things. We all have things that also come up in our life, you know, other little difficulties, but I have a child coming into the world now, but my wife suffers from a genetic disability there's no cure for. And it's kind of like, it's called Friedreich's ataxia. And it's kind of like MS. So she's kind of slowly degrading. And that's kind of hard when you're trying to recover from being exposed to death and chaos through combat and all that stuff. And you have to slowly watch the one you're most in love with in this world slowly wither away. It's kind of tough. So,
yeah,
of course, it would be great to have more sessions. But, of course, it's illegal And like I said, you can't ever forget the things you went through. I'm so much more able to talk about those things and share those experiences, but I'm not, I guess, completely free of anxiety. I realize though, I've had kind of anxiety all my life about things, but understanding the power of my breath has really helped me to use my breath as opposed to, you know, popping some anxiety pill. The other day, I wasn't on anything. I was staring out the window. I had this experience, like I thought flames were crawling up my back, and I haven't ever had that experience except for when I was actually somewhat on fire and in the Humvee when it was getting blown up, and then when I was experiencing that burning sensation under the MDMA. But I was just staring out the window in the morning. I just woke up. I was looking out the window, and it really felt like flames were crawling up my back and shoulders. So I had my bathrobe on. I just threw it off real quick, and I was trying to look for a fire, and there wasn't anything there. And I couldn't understand like what happened. I've had flashbacks in a sense to where they're just these visual daydreams that I get lost in, and my body really feels like they're there and they're in them, but nothing to where I've just been sober and felt like I was on flames. So there's a lot of unresolved things, most likely, because in my very first session, I forgave myself for the idea that I was some monster. And I realized how important that part of myself was. I mean, I'm alive, and a lot of my brothers are alive because of that part of me. And that was a survival part of me. And once I was able to, I guess, calm that monster down and realize I'm not in war, I'm not in combat, there's no threat here, I was able to really integrate that person and have the healing forgiveness that I needed.
I was just going to say that there's a scientific correlate to what Nick's talking about here, and a sort of a model for how MDMA helps. What happens is that the brain has a normal way for building memories, right, and the senses bring in all the information about an experience, and then into sort of a part of the brain, which the recent parts of the brain that sort of deals with thought, and that sorts the information for sort of context, and it relates it to all other experiences that you had in your life. And then after processing it for that kind of material, it sends it back down to the lower brain where it's stored as memory. But the theory is that when in a traumatic situation, like, you know, if you're being raped or if you're in combat, that it overwhelms the brain's ability to send that information out for processing. So it short circuits that, and it sends that stuff directly down to be stored as unresolved memories. And everything's locked together, all this sort of fear and anxiety, crippling fear and anxiety that you can't deal with at the moment because you've got to act in a survival mode. It just stays locked with, and the brain perceives the properties, these potent memories, as a threat. And it's sort of like a car alarm starts going on and nothing can shut it off. And that's sort of the car alarm is sort of like the symptoms of PTSD, you know, the hyper alertness. You're always on guard. You're always sort of dealing, and plus those images in your brain that your brain sort of is regarding them as a threat. So then there's another part of your brain that acts as a guard to keep those memories stuck down there in the basement. And yet it's not a perfect seal. And so it's almost like a poison in there. And in brain scans, what they discovered is that MDMA quiets the part of the body, the amygdala, which sort of handles the fear response, and that's sort of sealing those unresolved memories away. And it kind of quiets it down. And the feeling that people talk about when they're in therapy with MDMA is they say, I feel protected. Suddenly they feel like they don't have to be afraid. And so the amygdala lets its guard down, and those unresolved memories can then bubble up, and people also have enhanced memories, and they're suddenly able to revisit these traumatic memories without that fear reaction that has been causing all their symptoms. And so this allows those memories to go up and be processed. And, you know, that's where all the insights come in. And I think you heard Nick say that it was like, you know, he was able to look at this stuff in a completely different perspective. And it wasn't so fearsome now that he looked at it that way. And so they're able to reprocess those memories in a much more healthy way. And even though those memories, it's not like the memories disappear, they're still there. They're still horrible occurrences, but they're not running their life. They're not like running their life totally afraid of their own memories, you know, and that's the kind of thing you're hearing Nick say, that, you know, he still has these memories. They can still be difficult, but they're not like crippling him at this point.
Right. Jordan, do you remember your first ecstasy experience? Was it like feeling so safe and lovey-dovey and stuff like that?
Definitely lovey-dovey. Hard to say. My first one was pill that was probably mixed with some amphetamine, frankly. My first couple of experiences were all at music festivals or concerts or just being out there and, you know, using MDMA as it's mostly used today in popular culture for like parties.
Which it's worth emphasizing the point that it's rarely pure MDMA that you get when you buy this on the street. And it can be mixed with any number of things, some of which are quite dangerous.
Yeah, definitely. Just because it's yellow crystal doesn't mean it's Molly at all. But after those few initial experiences, a couple in, I finally closed my eyes at one of these outdoor events and was like, oh, wow, this is a whole lot more than just making me feel really good. And since then, my favorite place to experiment with MDMA has been at my house and with quiet and in a meditative state and watching the breathing. And I've seen how it can be tremendously helpful in just getting general insights about life or realizing things like maybe you don't love yourself as much as you think you do, or you're not as loving to other people. It is a tremendously healing drug.
Yeah, I agree. Like that aspect where you were talking about, Nick, about forgiving yourself. I think the first time I really experienced that on a deep emotional level was under the influence of MDMA.
Mm-hmm. What is the current availability of victims of PTSD to access MDMA therapy in the U.S.?
Well, it's very limited. There are a half dozen small-scale clinical trials now underway around the world. And there's one in Colorado ongoing. There's one in Canada. And there are a few others. And the study that Nick underwent is still ongoing in Charleston. But, you know, we're talking about a handful of dozen people who are able to benefit from this. So, you know, that's the real underlying problem, is the access is so limited. And the question is, you know, the results have been so good and the research is making such good progress that I would have no problem in predicting that MDMA psychotherapy for PTSD will no doubt be a prescription therapy at some point in the future. I think there's no question that it will be. However, the question is how long it's going to take.
Right.
And the most optimistic projections are 7 years. That's the most optimistic. And I think it's completely unrealistic, because every time the researchers make some kind of projection about how long things are going to take, it always takes twice as long as they think. For instance, this study that Nick was part of, I was told, you know, a year and a half ago that they thought that the study would be complete and they would have publication by the fall of this year. Well, the fall's come and gone, and they aren't even done with all the subjects yet. And once they get done with the subjects, publication is probably a year off from that. So instead of being like 9 months away, it was more like 2 years away. And that's been pretty typical for every time frame that they have. And it's not the researcher's fault. You know, the fault is that this is extremely expensive research to do. And instead of sort of getting the support, you know, of a government that has as many as 500,000 veterans coming back from a decade of war with severe PTSD that's going to possibly hamper them for the rest of their lives, veterans to whom they owe about $1 trillion in disability and health care over the next 30 or 40 years. And here is this incredibly promising treatment, probably the most promising treatment for PTSD that anybody has sort of found to this date. They've given like money to such things as the idea that maybe they could implant some kind of electronic chip, computer chip in the brain that will help control the sort of rage and fear that PTSD provokes, which is, you know, that is unbelievably speculative. But they're funding that kind of thing, but they haven't given a single dime to, and the FDA, which has the power to declare an urgently needed drug that shows promise, to put it on a kind of fast track that removes some of the hurdles to research. Instead, they've gone the other way, and between the FDA and the DEA, they've made trying to do this research a nightmare. And it's only through, and this is a lot of what acid test is about the, you know, unbelievable persistence and ingenuity and refusal to give up against huge odds that the researchers, Rick Doblin and Michael Midhofer and a handful of others, have done over a period of 30 years in order to make this happen. And what needs to happen now is that the government needs to wake up and realize, hey, we've got this massive, massive problem on our hands. And we need to not only get out of the way, but actually get behind this research and make it available as quickly as possible. And unfortunately, right now, that's not happening. And I'm certainly hoping that, you know, that the story I've told in acid test will have an impact and sort of help to foster that kind of thinking.
What exactly is so expensive about the research with MDMA?
Well, I mean, ultimately, in order to get a prescription drug, you have to have thousands of sessions with hundreds of subjects in dozens of locales around the country, all involving psychiatrists, and you have to have a place to do the therapy. You have to pay travel expenses for subjects to come in for the therapy and people's salaries to deal with it. So this is all very expensive. I mean, you know, imagine you're going to do 10,000 cancer treatments over a course of years, and the medical costs of that, how much that would add up. It would be, you know, tens of millions of dollars, and that's what they're facing. It's just medical research, clinical medical research is an extremely expensive proposition when you have to meet all these FDA requirements.
And Nick, what has the response been in the veteran community to just MDMA in general and the lack of availability?
Well, I mean, a lot of my vet friends I've talked to about it, who are, I guess, somewhat okay, or they fought with me, but, you know, they don't really suffer from PTSD as much. You know, they're all for it. And some of the guys that I know personally who are still suffering, it's hard. It really is, because you have like this survival's guilt kind of thing, like you're healed and they're not. So it can kind of make it difficult talking to them sometimes. But, you know, I share my story with them a lot, and they want it. They want the treatment because they're already on their last rope when it comes to suicide. And that's one of the hardest things for me, when you have guys that you fought with. And I mean, to do what you have to do over there, I have really no words can describe what it takes to do a lot of that stuff over there. But then you come back here and it's supposed to be so easy, but yet life seems so complicated and so difficult. to where you only feel like you have the option to take your life. And that's just, it shouldn't be that way. But they just, something in their heads just can't turn that, you know, turn that thing off in their head that turned them into the what they needed to be in combat. And they just can't function. Their family lives are falling apart. They can't hold jobs. And of course, it also comes down to like drinking and drug abuse. And it's really hard to hear about your brothers who are so brave and did what they did in combat, but yet are struggling back here. It just makes no sense. If anything, like those guys are the ones that actually put a personal stake into keeping, you know, what we believe America is supposed to be intact, whether the government is doing whatever they're doing to tear that apart. These type of people really believe in the people back here, and they put their lives down for that. Basically signing up and writing a blank check saying you can have everything up into my life for the country. And they offer that, and then they come back here and they can't get the medicine that they deserve. Their own leadership, you know, the Pentagon, won't even fund this. They would prefer to just herd us through like cattle and give us pills and put us through our little 1 hour time of talk. And that just, and most of these pills make guys even more suicidal. And it just messes with the head even more. I want this so badly to be available now, because you can't wait until 2021. That's with 22 veterans committing suicide every day. That's almost like 50,000 dead. Wow. By then. And it's probably going to even take longer to become a prescription, like Mom said. And that's a lot of dead. And those are the men and women, despite whatever job they did in the military, that had the capabilities to even stand up to a lot of the tyranny that exists in this world. And those people are fading away. And a lot of the youth in this world is very susceptible to being exposed to stuff. And you can't really have faith or hope in them coming up and changing the world. So the generations that exist now are the ones that are really going to have to make this change and start changing their perspectives on these medicines. Because that's one of the big issues. I live right here in the Bible Belt, Kentucky. And when I tell them the title of the book that I'm in, they just give me a big look like acid and that else, yeah, you know. And people, whenever a lot of my friends and family have read the book, they have a complete perspective change. I mean, especially when this is a veteran, you know, a Marine who went through this experience. And then it shows in the book of the healing I went through. You just really can't help but change your perspective when you actually see how it is that these medicines can heal. Because most people in the general public just know how they're abused. They don't know their healing potential.
All right.
So, I mean, it really is sad that my friends can't get the help that they need, they deserve. But I mean, that's like what Tom was saying, is hoping the book will help do, and about it, just, you know, spreading the word as much as you can. And usually when that happens, you get those people who are brave enough as well to rally around it. And we might be able to actually make things move faster if more people are aware, more people decide to help. So
I actually read the book Acid Test, and I have to say it's one of the most accessible books to psychedelics I ever read. And actually my girlfriend is reading it right now, and she likes it as well. And I can recommend everybody who's listening now to get the book. And if you know someone who doesn't understand that these plants and synthetic substances can be really used as medicines and can really heal people's lives, like, just give them the book and let them read it. It shows, especially your story was so gripping, because it really shows the place where you come from the PTSD. And then afterwards, especially going through the healing while under the influence of MDMA, for me, it was, wow. It reminded me so much of my own experience, but it provided also context that it can be great medicine for people with PTSD, but also just for anybody, really. It can really heal stuff you're dealing with as well. And so, yeah, I strongly support MAPS cause as it is. Tom, do you have like any future like jobs to promote psychedelics or what?
Well, I'm sort of committed to spending whatever time I can to get the word out about this and in going around talking about the book. I'm hoping that it has that effect. You know, what you said about the value of this goes beyond PTSD, obviously. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that there's been other research with people with no presenting psychological difficulties where they gave psilocybin to just normal, psychologically healthy individuals. And 70% of them in one study said it was one of the most important experiences of their lives. And these are people who'd never considered doing psychedelics before. So that's a pretty powerful thought to think, even for people without, you know, who are not suffering from any psychological disorder, find this to be, you know, up there with like the birth of their children and those kind of major life events. It's very interesting. And the question becomes, you know, there's clearly been damage done by unsupervised and unscreened and unthoughtful use of these drugs. But when they offer such, you know, such an opportunity to grow both in your own reality and spiritually, how does society sort of make these drugs available for this kind of almost, you could say, sacramental use for general spiritual development? And that's something where the questions have only begun to be asked. You know, what we're used to is a society is dealing with this in a medical model. So as I said, I think that definitely the drugs and therapy will be available for the use of psychiatry. And the question becomes, you know, when will they be legally available for people who simply, you know, want to grow as individuals?
And if you are interested in trying MDMA again or for your first time, just know that there are pill test kits you can buy online for like $15. And you just put a little bit of the pill in there and it'll turn a color that will tell you exactly the contents of that pill. So you know it can be safe.
And the other thing, just a few cautions out there for people who, I mean, it is still illegal, but, you know, if you're going to do it and you're able to test for purity, you need to also keep in mind that it has a effect on your body, which, you know, raises your bodily processes. And so if you are doing it in a place where you don't have adequate access to hydration, or it's hot and you're exercising like in a crowded bar or something and you're dancing, that it can bring on dangerous hyperthermia, overheating, which could actually lead to organ failure and death. And also, if you have any kind of previous psychological difficulties, to do it alone without kind of therapeutic supervision, you can be putting yourself at risk for some, you know, possibly psychotic breaks or at least acute anxiety. So, you know, this is not something that should be done lightly just for fun. This is serious and powerful medicine.
Definitely.
I always say treat them like a loaded gun.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Oh, we actually had Rick Doblin on the show a couple of weeks ago. And he told us that in the RAVE Act in the United States, harm reduction programs in clubs are actually illegal, because then it implies that drugs are being used in the club. And for me, that's just like another symptom of our twisted relationship with all the states of consciousness. It's how can you illegalize harm reduction? Like, it's the same. How can you not, like, do more research in these beneficial effects if it can help so many people. It just boggles my mind.
Yeah, well, that's been the frustrating thing because, you know, there are all these dangerous drugs that do not heal. At best, they cover up symptoms, and they do that imperfectly. And in fact, they have all these harmful side effects that are prescription drugs that are used, you know, that are in use among millions of people, that you can do research on them without all these obstacles to go through. Whereas these drugs that actually get to the root of your problem and heal, and you don't need to keep taking them, you do it until it's healed, and then you don't need them anymore. Those are the drugs that they pick to be vigilant. It's just insane.
And do psychedelics still play a role in your life, Tom?
Well, I sort of went on to have a professional career and I had a family and they were still illegal. I kind of stopped doing them. But when I was writing this book, I did have occasion to try MDMA because I'd never done it before. And also I found access to some psilocybin because I felt like I really wanted to understand the mind state and, you know, my experiences 30, 35 years before, I didn't feel that was adequate. So that was actually extremely helpful.
How was your first experience with MDMA?
Well, it was interesting, you know, because I've been talking to Nick for quite some time and you heard his story and how, you know, how impressive his story was. And, you know, when I did MDMA, I kind of sat in the chair and there was some music on and I was sitting there thinking about, okay, what insights am I going to have? And then just one thing just overwhelmingly occurred to me. And I'm thinking in comparison to Nick, I'm saying, I have no problem. My life is completely good. And I just have no problem. So I spent like a couple hours sitting there sort of awe of, you know, how lucky and fortunate I was. So that was the way I responded. But I could also see very clearly the unbelievable relief if you were being tortured by your own thoughts to suddenly have that shut down completely and the relief that would bring. I really could see that extremely clearly in that experience.
Hmm. Yeah, Rick, when we talked to him 2 weeks ago, he also mentioned that they had inadvertently discovered through PTSD therapy that MDMA was also good for couples therapy. They're bringing veteran significant others in into therapy with them. It's just such a versatile.
Well, I think that the same thing, that lack of that shutting down of this sort of fear mechanism would make that kind of communication where you could actually both say and hear things that would normally make you react without any, and you sort of divorce that sort of pain reaction to hear if somebody says something that's difficult to hear under normal circumstances. If you have that fear response sort of quieted, then you can listen to it and consider it for what it is rather than for how you react to it. And so you can really see how that it would be a tremendous advantage in couples therapy, because so often the problem in a relationship is that each person has difficulties in it, and yet every time they try to express those difficulties, it only provokes defensiveness in their partner.
Well, it looks like we're running out of time here, but wow, this has been a riveting podcast. It's really tugged at my own heartstrings. Thank you so much for you guys for coming on, and especially Nick for sharing that story and really diving into your past to help the mission of MDMA therapy here.
Yeah, and we really appreciate you bringing as much attention to this as possible. That's great, so thank you.
It's no effort at all. It's really amazing to hear you guys speak, and you know, I feel we're on the same level. We continue to fight. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you. Bye.
Bye. Nice,
thank you.
I
I am very thankful for Tom and Nicholas that they took the energy and willingness to come on the show and share their story of transformation with us. If you have found any value in this podcast, please consider buying the book Acid Test or make a donation to the nonprofit organization MAPS, who made this therapy, which is unfortunately still in its experimental phase, possible. Thank you.
See you.